Welcome! Today we're going to read my favourite book called Percy Jackson and the Lightning Thief, wrote by Rick Riordan. Let's begin now! Chapter 1. I accidentally vaporised my maths teacher. Look, I didn't want to be a half-blood. If you're reading this, because you might think you might be one. My advice is close this book right now. Believe whatever lie your mum or dad told you about your birth and try to live to a normal life. Being a half-blood is dangerous. It's scary. Most of the time it gets you killed in painful, nasty ways. If you're a normal kid reading this because you think it's fiction, great, read on. I envy you for being able to believe that none of this ever happened. But if you recognize yourself in these pages, if you feel something stirring inside, stop reading immediately. You might be one of us, and once you know that, it's only a matter of time before they sense it too. And they'll come for you. Don't say I didn't warn you. My name is Percy Jackson. I'm a 12-year-old. Until a few months ago, I was a boarding student at Yancey Academy, a private school for troubled kids in upstate New York. Am I a troubled kid? Yeah, you could say that. Right then and there, in school, suspension would have been nothing compared to the mess I was about to get myself into. Mr. Bruno led the museum tour. He rode up front in his wheelchair, guiding us through the big echoing galleries past marble statues and glass cases, full of really old black and orange pottery. It blew my mind that this stuff had survived 2,000-3,000 years. He gathered us around a 4-meter-tall stone column with a big sphinx on top and started telling us how it was a grave marker of steel. For a girl about our age, he told whatever he had to say because it was a kind of interesting, but everyone around me was talking, and every time I told them to shut up, the chaperone, Mrs. Dodge, would give me an evil eye. Mrs. Dodge was this little maths teacher for Georgina, who always wore a black leather jacket, even though she was a 50-year-old. She looked mean enough to ride a Harley right into your locker. But she had come to Yancey halfway through the year, when our last maths teacher had a nervous breakdown. From her first day, Mrs. Dodd loved Nancy Boba Fett and figured I was devil spawn. She would point a crooked finger at me and say, "Now, honey, real sweet." And I knew I was going to go get after school detention for a month. One time, after she'd made me erase answers out of the old maths workbooks until midnight, I told Grover I didn't think Miss Dodd was human. He looked at me real serious, and you're absolutely right. Mr. Bruno kept talking about Greek funeral art. Finally, Nancy Boba Fett snickered around about the naked guy on the stair, and I walked around and said, "Will you shut up?" It came out that the whole group laughed. Mr. Bruno stopped his story. "Mr. Jackson," he said, "did you have a comment?" My face was totally red. I said, "No, sir." Mr. Bruno pointed to one of the pictures on the stair. "Maybe you'll tell us what the picture represents." I looked at the carving and felt a flush of relief because I actually recognized it. "That's Cronos eating his kids, right?" "Yes," Mr. Bruno said, obviously not satisfied. "And he did this because, well, I racked my brain to remember. Cronos was the king god and god Titan," I corrected myself. "He didn't trust his kids, who were the gods, so Cronos ate them, right? But his wife hid baby Zeus and gave Cronos a rock to eat instead. And isn't then when Zeus grew up, he tricked his dad Cronos into bathing up his brothers and sisters." "Ew," said one of the girls behind me. "And so there was a big fight between the gods and the Titans," I continued, "and the gods won." Some snickers from the group. Behind me, Nancy Boba Fett mumbled to a friend, like, "We're going to use this in real life. Like it's going to stay on our job applications. Please explain why Cronus ate his kids and why, Mr. Jackson?" Bruno said to Paraphrase Miss Bubfist's excellent question. Does this matter in real life? Busted, Grover muttered. Shut up, Nancy hissed. Her face even brighter red than her hair. At least Nancy got in trouble, too. Mr. Bruno was the only one who ever caught her saying anything wrong. He had radar ears. I thought about this question, and he shrugged. I don't know, sir. I see Mr. Bruno looked disappointed. Well, half credit, Mr. Jackson. Zeus did indeed feed Cronus a mixture of mustard and wine, which made him disgorge his other five children, who, of course, became immortal gods and have been living and growing up completely undigested in the Titan's stomach. The gods defeated their father, sliced him to tiny pieces with their own scythe, and scattered his remains in the depths of Tartarus, the darkest part of the underworld. On that happy note, it's time for lunchtime. Miss Dodge, would you lead us back outside? The class drifted off, the girls holding their stomachs, the guys pushing each other around and acting like doofuses. Robin and I were about to follow when Mr. Bruno said, Mr. Jackson! I knew that was coming. I told Grover to keep going. Then I turned around, Mr. Bruno, sir. Mr. Bruno had this look that would have let you go. Intense brown eyes that could have been 1,000 years old and had seen everything. You must learn this question, Mr. Bruno told me, about the Titans, about real life, and how your studies apply to it. Oh, what you learn for me, he said, it's vitally important. I expect you to treat it as such. I will expect only the best from you, Miss Percy Jackson. I wanted to get angry. This guy pushed me so hard. I mean, sure, it was kind of cool on tournament days when he dressed up in the suit of Roman armor and shouted, What ho! And challenged a sword point against Chalk to run to the board and name every Greek and Roman person who ever lived. And the mother and what god they worshipped. Mr. Bruno accepted me to be as good as everybody else, despite the fact I have dyslexia and attention difficult disorder. I've never made above a C in my life, no. He didn't expect me to be as good. He expected me to be better. And I just couldn't learn all those names and facts must spell, let's spell them correctly. I mumbled something about trying harder while Mr. Bruno took one long, sad look at the stall, like he's been at this girl's funeral. He told me to go outside and eat my lunch. The class gathered under the footsteps of the museum where we could watch the foot traffic along Fifth Avenue. Overhead, a huge storm was brewing, with clouds blacker than I ever seen above this city. I figured maybe it was global warming or something, because the weather all across New York State had been weird since Christmas. We'd have massive snowstorms, flooding, wildfires from lightning strikes. I would have been surprised if this was a hurricane blowing in. Nobody else seemed to notice. Some of the guys were pelting pigeons with Lunchable crackers. Nancy Burgers were trying to pickpocket someone from a lady's bag, and of course Mrs. Dodge wasn't seeing a thing. Grover and I sat on the edge of the fountain away from the others. We thought that maybe if we did that, everybody wouldn't know that we were from that school. The school for loser freaks. Who couldn't make it elsewhere? Detention? Grover asked. Nah. I said, not from Bruno. I just wish he'd lay off me sometimes. I mean, I'm not a genius. Grover didn't say anything for a while. Then when I thought he was going to give me some deep philosophical comment to make me feel better, he said, can I have your apple? I didn't have much time over an apple, so I let him take it. I watched a stream of cabs going down Fifth Avenue and then about my mom's apartment, only a little way uptown for where we sat. I hadn't seen her since Christmas. I wanted to so bad to jump into a taxi and head home. She'd hug me and glad to see me. But she'd be disappointed too. She'd send me right back to Yancey, remind me that I had to try harder, even if this was my sixth school in 6 years. I was probably going to get kicked out again. I wouldn't have been able to stand that sad look she'd give me. Mr. Broomer parked his wheelchair at the basement of the handicapped ramp. Yet celery while he would read a paperback novel. A red umbrella stuck up from the back of his wheelchair, making it look like a motorized cafe table. I was about to unwrap my salad when Nancy Bobfit appeared in front of me with her ugly friends. I guess she'd gotten tired of stealing from the tourists and dumped her half-eaten lunch in Grover's lap. Oops, she grinned and showed me with her gruesome teeth. Her freckles were orange. If anyone had spray painted her face with liquid Cheetos. I tried to stay cool. The school counselor had told me a million times, time to think, get control of your temper. But I was so mad, my mind went blank. A wave roared in my ears. I don't remember touching her, but the next thing I knew, Nancy was sitting on her butt in the fountain screaming, Percy, push me! Miss Dodds materialized next to us. Some of the kids were whispering, did you see the water like it grabbed her? I didn't know what they were talking about. All I knew was that I was in trouble. As soon as Miss Dodds was sure poor little Nancy was okay, promised to get a new teacher at the museum gift shop, etc, etc. Miss Dodds turned on me. There was a triumphant fire in her eyes, as if I'd done something she'd been waiting for all semester. Now, honey, I know, I grumbled. A month of erasing textbook, that wasn't the right thing to say. Come on with me, Miss Dodds said. Wait, Grover yelled. It was me. I pushed her. I stared at him, stunned. I couldn't believe he was trying to cover me. Miss Dodds scared Grover to death. She glared at him so hard his whiskey chin trembled. I don't think so, Mr. Underwood, she said, but you will stay here. River looked at me desperately. It's okay, man, I told him. Thanks for trying. Miss Honey, Miss Dodds barked at me. Now, Nancy Bourbonnet smirked. I gave her my deluxe I'll kill you later stare. Then I turned to face Miss Dodds. But she wasn't there. She was standing at the museum at the way at the top of the steps, gesturing impatiently at me to come over. How'd she get so fast? I remember like I have a brain force asleep or something. But the next thing I know, I've missed something. As if a puzzle feet fell out of the universe, left me staring blank place behind it. The school counselor told me this was part of my ADHD band, my brain. Misinterpreting things. I wasn't so sure. I went after Miss Dodds. Halfway up the steps, I glanced at Grover. He was looking pale, cutting his eyes between me and Mr. Bruno, like he wanted Mr. Bruno to notice what was going on. But Mr. Bruno was absorbed in his novel. I looked back up. Miss Dodds had disappeared again. She was now outside the building at the end of the entrance hall. Okay, so she's gone to me to buy a new teacher for Nancy at the gift shop. But apparently that wasn't the plan. I followed her deeper into the museum when I finally caught up to her in the Greek and Roman section. Except for us, the gallery was empty. Miss Dodds stood with her arms crossed in the marble frieze of the Greek god. She was making this weird noise in her throat, like growling. Even without this noise, I would have been nervous. It's weird being alone with the teacher, especially Miss Dodds. Think about the way she looked at me. Fries as if she wanted to pulverize me. You've been giving us problems, honey, she said. I did the safe thing. I said, yes, ma'am. She tucked on the cuffs of my leather jacket. Did you really think you would get away with this? She looked in her eyes beyond mad. It was evil. She's a teacher, I thought nervously. It's not like she's going to hurt me. I said, I'll try harder, ma'am. Thunder shook the building. We are not fools, Percy Jackson, Miss Dodds said. It was only a matter of time we found you out, confess, and you would suffer less pain. I didn't know what she was talking about. All I could chew of that teacher must have found the illegal stash of candy I'd been selling out of my dorm room. Or maybe she'd realized I got my essay on Tom Sawyer from the internet, without even reading a book, and now we're going to take away my grade. Or worse, they were making me read the book. Well, she demanded, ma'am. I don't. Your time is up, she hissed. Then the weirdest thing happened. Her eyes began to glow barbecue coals. Her fingers stretched into talons. Her jacket melted into large leathery rings. She wasn't human. She was a shriveled hag with bat wings and claws and mouth full of yellow fangs. She was about to slice me to ribbons. Then things got even stranger. Mr. Bruno, who'd been out in the humid of the museum a minute before, wheeled his chair into the door of the gallery holding a pen in his hand. What ho, Percy, he shouted. I tossed the pen through his inner. Miss Dodd lunged at me with a yelp. I dodged a felt tennis, slashed the air next to my ear. I snatched a ballpoint point and but when it hit my hand, it wasn't penable. It was a sword! Mr. Bruner, broadsword which he actually used on tournament day. Mrs. Dodd spun towards me with a murderous look in her eyes. My knees were jelly. My hands were shaking so bad I almost dropped the sword. She snarled, "Die, honey," and she flew straight at me. Absolute terror ran through my body. I did the only thing that came naturally. I swung the sword. The metal blade hit her shoulder and passed clean through her body, if she were made of water. Hiss! Miss Dodd was a sandcastle in a power fan. She exploded into yellow powder, vaporized on the spot, leaving nothing but the smell of sulfur and a dying screech, and a chill of evil in the air. If those two glowing red eyes were still watching me, I was alone. There was a ballpoint pen in my hand. Mr. Bruno wasn't there. Nobody was there but me. My hands were still trembling. My lunch must have been contaminated with magic mushrooms or something. Had I imagined the whole thing? I went back inside. It had started to rain. Grover was sitting by the fountain, a museum map tented over his head. Nancy Boba Fett was still standing there, soaked from her swim in the fountain, grumbling to her ugly fins. When she told me, "I hope Mrs. Kerr whipped your butt." I said, "Who? Our teacher, duh." I blinked. We have no teacher called Mrs. Kerr, I asked Nancy. She was talking about it. She just rolled her eyes, and I asked Grover where Mrs. Dodds were. He said, "Who?" He paused, and she looked at me, so I went, "Not funny, man," I told him. "This is serious." Thunder boomed overhead. I saw Mr. Bruner sitting under his red umbrella reading his book as if never moved. I went over to him. He looked like distracted. "Ah, that would be my pen. Please bring it. Your own writing utensil in the future, Mr. Jackson." I handed it over. I hadn't realized it was still holding it. "Sir," I said, "where's Mrs. Dodds?" He stared at me blankly. "Who?" "The other chaperone, Mrs. Dodds, the maths teacher." He frowned at me and sat towards, looking mildly concerned. "Percy, there's no Mrs. Dodds on this trip. As far as I know, there had never been a Mrs. Dodds at the Yancey Academy. Are you feeling all right?" Three Old Ladies Knit the Socks of Death, Chapter 2. I was used to the occasionally weird experience, but usually they were over quickly. This 24-hour, 7 hallucination, was more than I could handle. For the rest of the school year, the entire campus seemed to be playing some kind of trick on me. The students acted as if they were completely and totally convinced that Mrs. Kerr, a perky blonde woman that one might never seen my whole life. She got on our bus at the end of the field trip and had a maths teacher since Christmas. Every so often, I would bring a Mrs. Dodds reference on somebody just to see if I could trip them up. But they would just stare at me like I was psycho. It got so I almost believed that Mrs. Dodds had never existed. Almost. But Grover couldn't fool me. When I mentioned the name Dodds to him, he would hesitate and claim she didn't exist. But I knew he was lying. Something was going on. Something had happened at the museum. I didn't have much time to think about it during the days, but at night, visions of Miss Dodd with talons and leathery wings would wake me up in the cold sweat. The freak weather continued, which didn't help my mood. One night, a thunderstorm blew out the windows in my dorm room. A few days later, the biggest tornado ever spotted in Hudson Valley touched down only 50 miles from Yancey Academy. One of the current events we studied in social studies class was the unusual number of small planes that had gone down in the southern schools in the Atlantic that year. I started feeling cranky and irritable. Most of the time, my grades slipped from D's to F's. I got into more fights with Nancy Boba Fett and her friends. I was sent out into the hallway in almost every class. Finally, when our English teacher, Mr. Nicole, asked me for the millionth time why I was so lazy to study for spelling tests, I snapped. I called him an old sot. I wasn't even sure what it meant, but it sounded good. The headmaster sent my mum a letter the following week, making it official. I would not be invited back next year to Yancey Academy. Finally, I told myself just fine. If I was homesick, I wanted to be with my mom in our little apartment on the Upper East Side. Even if I had to go to the public school and put up my obnoxious stepfather at his stupid poker parties. And yet, there were things I'd miss at Yangtze. The view of the woods at my dorm window, the Hudson River in the distance, the smell of pine trees. I miss Gerard Root. Been a good friend, even if he was a little strange. I wonder how he'd survive next year without me. I missed Latin class too, Mr. Bruner's crazy tournament days and his faith that I could do well. As exam week got closer, Latin was the only test I studied for. I hadn't got what Mr. Bruner had told me about the subject being my life and death to me. I wasn't sure what he started to believe. The evening before my final, I got so much that I threw the Cambridge Guide to Greek Mythology across my dorm room. Words have been swimming off the page, circling my head, letters doing 180s as if they were riding skateboards. There was no way I was going to remember the difference between Chiron and Charon, or polydeictics and polydeuces. And conjuncting those Latin verbs, forget it. I paced the room, feeling like ants were crawling around my shirt. I remembered Mr. Bruner's serious expression, his thousand-year-old eyes only expect the best of you from Percy Jackson. I took a deep breath. I picked up the mythology book. I'd never asked a teacher for help before. Maybe if I talked to Mr. Bruner, he could give me some pointers. At least I could apologize for the big fat F. I was about to score on his exam. I didn't want to leave Lancy Academy with him thinking I hadn't tried. I walked downstairs to the faculty offices. Most of them were dark and empty. Mr. Bruner's door was ajar. Light from his window stretched across the hallway's floor. I was there, 3 steps from the door handle, when I heard a voice inside the office. Mr. Bruner asked a question, a voice that was definitely ghosted, worried about Percy, sir. I froze. I'm not usually an eavesdropper, but I dare you to try not listening if you heard your best friend talking about you to an adult. I inched closer. Alone this summer, Grover was saying. I mean, a kind one in the school. And now that we know for sure, and they know too. We would only make matters worse by rushing him, Mr. Bruner said. We need the boy to mature more. But he may not have time. The summer solstice deadline. We'll have to resolve without him, Grover. Let him enjoy his ignorance while he still can. Sir, he saw her. His imagination, Miss Bruner insisted, the mist over his shoes as staff will be enough to convince him of that. Sir, I can't fail my duties again, Grover's voice was choked with emotion. You know what that would mean. You haven't failed, Grover, Mr. Bruner said kindly. I should have seen her for what she really was. Now, let's just worry about keeping Percy alive until next autumn. The mythology book dropped out of my hands and hit the floor with a thud. Mr. Bruner went silent. My heart hammering, I picked up the book and back down the hall. A shadow slid through the lighted glass of Bruner's office door. The shadow, something much taller than my wheelchair, bound the teacher, holding something that looked suspiciously like an archer's bow. I opened the nearest door, slipped inside. A few seconds later, I heard a slow clop, 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 like muffled wood blocks, then sound like an animal snuffling right outside my door. A large dark shape paused in front of the glass, then moved on. A bead of sweat trickled down my neck. Somewhere in the hallways, Mr. Bruner spoke nothing, he murmured. My notes hadn't been right since the winter solstice. My neither, Grover said, but I could have sworn. Go back to the dorm. Mr. Bruner told him, you've got a long day of exams tomorrow. Don't remind me. The light went out in Mr. Bruner's office. I waited until the dark would seem forever. Finally, I slipped out of the hallway and made my way back up to the dorm. Grover was lying on his bed, signing his Latin exam notes like he'd been there all night. Hey, he said, Lydia, you got to get ready for the exam? I didn't answer. You look awful, he frowned. Is everything okay? Just tired. I turned so he could read my expression and started getting ready for bed. I didn't understand what I'd heard that downstairs. I wanted to believe I'd imagined the whole thing. But one thing was clear. Grover and Mr. Bruno were talking about me behind my back. They thought I was in some kind of danger. The next afternoon, as I was leaving the 3-hour Latin exam, my eyes swimming with all the Greek and Roman names I'd misspelled, Mr. Bruno called me back inside for a moment. After all, he'd found out my eavesdropping the night before, but that didn't seem to be the problem. "Percy," he said, "don't be discouraged about leaving Nancy. It's for the best." His tone was kind, but the words still embarrassed me. Even though he was speaking quietly, the other kids finishing the test could hear. Nancy Bobofit smirked at me and made sarcastic little kissing emotions with her lips. I mumbled, "Okay, sir." Mr. Bruno wheeled his chair back and forth like he wasn't sure what to say. "This isn't the right place for you. It was only a matter of time." My eyes stung. Here was my favorite teacher, in front of the class, telling me I couldn't handle it. After saying he believed me all year, now he's telling me I was destined to get kicked out. "Right," I said, trembling. "No, no," Mr. Bruno said. "Oh, confound it all. What I'm trying to say is, you're not normal, Percy. That's nothing to be." "Thanks," I blurted. "Thanks a lot, sir, for reminding me, Percy," but I was already gone. On the last day of term, I shoved my clothes into my suitcase. The other kids were joking around talking about their vacation plans. One of them was going for a hiking trip to Switzerland. Another was cruising the Caribbean for a month. They were juvenile delinquents, but like me, but they were rich juvenile delinquents. Their daddies were executed or ambassadors or celebrities. I was a nobody from a family of nobodies. They asked me what I'd been doing this summer, and I told them I was going back to the city. What I didn't tell them that I'd have to spend my whole summer job, walking dogs or selling magazines, subscriptions, and spend my free time worrying about where I had to go to school in the autumn. "Oh," one of the guys said, "that's cool." They went back to their conversations as if I never existed. The only person I did say goodbye to was Grover. But as it turned out, I didn't have to. He just booked a ticket to Manhattan on that same Greyhound as I had. We were together headed into the city. During the whole bus ride, Grover kept glancing nervously down the aisle, watching the other passengers. It occurred to me that he'd always acted nervous and fidgety when we left Nancy, as if he expected something bad to happen. Before, I'd always assumed he was worried about getting teased, but there was nobody to tease him on the Greyhound. Finally, I couldn't stand it anymore. I said, "Look, King, for kindly ones." Grover nearly jumped out as I said, What do you mean?" I confessed about eavesdropping on him and Mr. Bruno the night before the exam. Grover's eyes tricked. "How much did you hurt?" "Not much." "What's the summer solstice deadline?" He winced. "Look, Percy, I was just worried for you, see? I'm hallucinating about demons math teacher Grover. And I was telling Mr. Bruno that maybe you were overstressed or something because there was no person as Mrs. Dodds and..." "Grover, you're a really, really bad liar." He has turned pink. From his hurty, grubbly business card, "Just take this, okay? In fact, you need me this summer." The card was in fancy script which was murder on my dyslexia's eyes. I finally made out something like Grover Underwood, Keeper of Half Blood Hill, Long Island, New York, 800-009-0009. "What's half? Don't say it aloud," he yelled. "That's my summer address." My heart sank. Grover had a summer home? I never considered that his family might be as rich as the others at Yancey. "Okay," I said glumly. "So, like, if I want to come and visit your mansion," he nodded, or "if you need me." "Why would I need you?" It came out harsher than I meant it to. Grover blushed right down to the Adam's apple. "Look, Percy, the truth is, I kind of have to protect you." I stared at him. All year long, I'd gotten into fights and keep bullies away from him. I lost sleep worrying he'd get beaten up next year without me. And here was he acting like he was the one who defended me. "Grover," I said, "what exactly are you protecting me from?" There's a huge grinding noise under our feet. Black smoke poured from the dashboard, and the whole bus filled with smoke like rotten eggs. The driver cursed and limped the Greyhound over to the side of the highway. After a few minutes clanking around in the engine compartment, the driver announced that we'll have to get off. Grover and I filed outside with everybody else. We were all stretched off the country road. No place you'd notice if you don't break down here. On our side of the highway, there was nothing but maple trees and litter from passing cars. On the other side, across four lanes of asphalt, shimmering with afternoon heat, was an old-fashioned fruit stand. The stuff on sale looked really good, heaping boxes of blood-red cherries and apples, walnuts, apricots, jugs of cider in a clawfoot tub full of ice. There was no customers, just three old ladies sitting in the rocking chairs in the shade of the maple tree knitting three big socks. I mean, these socks were the size of sweaters, but they were clearly socks. The lady on the right knitted one of them and made an enormous basket of electric blue yarn. All three women looked ancient, with pale faces wrinkled like fruit leather. Silver hair tied back into white bandanas, but bony arms sticking out of bleached cotton dresses. The weirdest thing that they seemed to be looking straight at me. Grover and I looked at Grover to say something about this and then saw his blonde hair drained from his face. His nose was twitching. Grover, I said, "Hey, man, Tommy is not looking at you. They aren't they? Yeah, weird, huh? They looked at me. Not funny, Percy. Not funny at all." The old lady in the middle took out a pair of scissors, the gold and silver long bladed like shears. I heard Grover catch his breath. "We're getting on the bus," he told me. "Come on." "What?" "I said, it's 1,000 degrees in here." "Come on," he cries. "Open the door and climb inside, but I stay back." Across the road, and the old lady was still watching me. The middle one cut the yarn. I swear I could hear the snip across the four lanes of traffic. Her two friends pulled up the electric blue socks, leaving me to wonder who they'd probably be. Sasquatch or Godzilla? At the rear of the bus, the driver wrenched a big chunk of smoke metal out of the engine compartment. The bus shuddered and the engine roared back to life. The passengers cheered. "Darn right," yelled the driver. He slapped the bus with his hat. "Everybody back on board." Once we were going, I started feeling feverish, as if I'd just caught the flu. Grover didn't look much better. He was shivering and his teeth were chattering. "Grover?" "Yeah?" "What are you not telling me?" He dabbed his forehead with his shirt. "Percy, what did you see back at the fruit stand? You mean the old ladies? What is about them, man? They're not like Miss Dodds, are they?" His expression was hard to read, but I got the feeling that the fruit stand lady was something much, much, much worse than Miss Dodds. He said, "Just tell me what you saw." The middle one took off the set as he cut the yarn. He closed his eye and made a gesture with his fingers. That might have been crossing himself, but it was something like much older. He said, "You saw her snip the cord, yes, sir?" But even as I said it, I knew a big deal. "This is not happening," Grover mumbled. He started chewing at his thumb. "I don't want him to be the last time." "What last time?" "Always sixth grade. They never get past six." "Grover," I said, because that really started scaring me. "What are you talking about?" "Let me walk you home to the bus station. Promise me." This seemed like a strange request to me, but I promised he could. "Is this like a superstition or something?" I asked. "No." Answer. "Grover, that's snipping off the yarn. Does that mean somebody's going to die?" He looked at me mournfully. He was already picking up the kind of flowers I like best on my coffin. Chapter 3. Grover unexpectedly loses his trousers. Confession time. I dissed Grover as soon as we got to the bus terminal. I know, it was rude, but Grover was freaking me out. Looking at me like I was a dead man muttering, "Why does this always happen? And why does it always have to be sixth grade?" Whenever he got upset, Grover's bladder acted up, so I wasn't surprised when, as soon as we got off the bus, he would promise to wait for him, then made a beeline for the restroom. Instead of waiting, I got my suitcase, slipped out outside, and caught the first taxi uptown. "East 104th and East 1st Avenue," I told the driver. A word about my mother. Before you meet her, her name is Sally Jackson, and she's the best person in the world, which she proves my theory that the best person has the rottenest luck. Her parents died in a plane crash when she was 5, and she was raised by an uncle who didn't care much about her. She wanted to be a novelist, so she spent high school trying to save enough money for college with a good creative writing program. Then her uncle got cancer, and she had to quit school in her senior year to take care of him. After he died, she was left with no money, no family, and no diploma. The only good break she'd ever got was meeting my dad. I don't have any memories of him, just this sort of warm glow, although maybe the barest track of a smile. My mom doesn't like to talk about this anymore because it makes her sad. She has no pictures. They weren't married. She told me he was rich and important and their relationship was a secret. Then one day he set sail across the Atlantic on some important journey and he never came back. Lost at sea, my mom told me. Not dead, lost at sea. She worked odd jobs, took night classes to get her high school diploma and raised me on her own. She never complained or got mad, not even once. But I knew I wasn't an easy kid. While she married Gabe Ugliano, who was nice the first 30 seconds we knew him. Then he showed his true colors as a world-class jerk. But when I was young, I nicknamed him Smelly Gabe. I'm sorry, it's the truth. The guy reeked like moldy garlic pizza wrapped in gym shorts. Between the two of us, we made my mum's life pretty hard. The way Smelly Gabe treated her, the way I got along well, when I came home, is a good example. I walked in our little apartment, and my mum would be home from work, and says Smelly Gabe was in the living room playing poker with his buddies. The television was blaring. Crisp red beer cans were strewn all over the carpet. Hardly looking up, he said to his cigar, "So you're home." "Where's my mum?" "Working," he said. "You got any cash?" That was it. No welcome back. "Good to see you. How has your day life been the last 6 months?" Gabe put on weight. Looked like a tussless walrus in thrift store clothes. He had about 3 hairs on his head, all combed up over his bald scalp. If he that made him handsome or something. He managed the electronics mega mart in Queens, but he stayed home most of the time. I don't know why he hadn't been fired long before. He just kept on collecting play checkers, spending his money on cigars that made me nauseous, and on beer, of course. Always beer. Whenever I was with him, he expected me to provide his gambling for us. He called that our guy's seekers. Meanwhile, I told my mom he would punch my lights out. "I don't have cash," I told him. He raised a greedy eyebrow. Gabe could slip out money like a bloodhound, which was surprising since his own smell should have covered up everything else. "You took the hat taxi from the bus station," he said, "probably paid with a 20. Got 6-7 bucks in change. Somebody explicitly from this group who ought to carry his own ways. Am I right, Eddie?" Eddie, the superintendent of the apartment building, looked at me, twinge of sympathy. "Come on, Gabe," he said. "The kid just got here." "Am I right?" Gabe repeated. Eddie scowled into his bottle of Prestles. The other two guys passed gas in harmony. "Fine," I said. I dug a wad of dollars out of my pocket. I threw the money on the table. "I hope you lose. Your report card came back, brain boy," he shouted after me. "I wouldn't act so snooty." I slammed the door to my room, which wasn't really my room. During school months, it was Gabe's study. He didn't study anything in there except old car magazines, but he loved shoving my stuff in the closet, leaving his muddy boots on my windowsill, and doing his best to make the place smell like a nasty cologne and cigars and stale beer. I dropped my suitcase on the bed. Home, sweet home. Gabe's smell was almost worse than the nightmares about Miss Dodds, or the sound of that old fruit lady's shears snipping the yarn. But as soon as I thought, my leg felt weak. I remember Gabe Gervis look panic. He'd make me promise I wouldn't go home without him. A sudden chill rolled through me. I felt like someone was about to looking for me right now, maybe pounding his way up the stairs, growing that long, horrible tongue. Then I heard my mom's voice. "Percy?" She opened the bedroom door and my fears melted. Mother made me feel good by walking into the room. Her eyes sparkled and changed color in the light. Her smile was warm as a quilt. She got a few gray streaks mixed in with her long brown hair, but I never think of her as old. When she looks at me, it's like she's seeing all the good things in me, about about me, none so bad. I've never heard her raise the voice or say unkind words to anyone, not even me or Gabe. Hey, oh, Percy, she hugged me tight. I can't believe it, you've grown since Christmas. Her red, white, and blue sweet on her American uniform smelled like the best things in the world. Chocolate, licorice, all the stuff she sold at the candy shop in the Grand Central. She brought me a huge bag of free sample the way she did when I came home. She said, we sat in the end of the grid while I tackled the blueberry sour strings. She ran her head through my hair and demanded to know everything I hadn't put in my letters. She didn't mention about anything about her, my getting expelled. She didn't even seem to care about that. But was I okay? Was her little boy doing all right? I told her she was smothering me and to lay off and all that. But secretly, I was really, really, really glad to see her. From the other room, Gabe yells, hey, Sally, how about some bean dip, huh? I gritted my teeth. My mom is the nicest lady in the world. She should have been married to a millionaire, not to some jerk like Gabe. For her sake, I tried to sound upbeat about my last date at Yancey County. I told her I wasn't too down about the explosion. I lasted almost a whole year this time. At Gabe's eyes narrowed. His tiny brain was probably to detect sarcasm in my voice. I made some new friends. I've done well in Latin, and honestly, the fights hadn't been as bad as the headmaster said. I like Yancey Academy. I really had. I put such a good spin on the year. I almost convinced myself. I started choking up, thinking about Grover and Mr. Brunner, even Nancy Bobofit. Sally didn't seem so bad until the trip to the museum. What my mom was? Her eyes tugged at me, trying to pull out the secrets. Did something scare you? No, Mom. I felt bad lying. I wanted to tell her about Mrs. Dawson and the 3-year-old lady with the arm. I thought it would sound stupid. She pressed her lips. She knew I was holding back something. She didn't push me. I have a surprise for you. We're going to the beach. My eyes widened. Montauk, 3 nights, same cabin. When? She smiled as soon as I get changed. I couldn't believe it. My mom and I hadn't been to Montauk at the last 2 summers because Gabe said there wasn't enough money. Gabe appeared in the door and I grabbed bean dip. Sally, didn't you hear me? I wanted to punch him. I met my mom's my mom's eyes and I understood. She was offering me a deal. Be nice to Gabe for a little while. Just like who she was ready to leave for Montauk. We were just talking about the trip. Gabe's eyes turned small. The trip, you mean? You're serious about that? I knew it. I muttered, he won't let us go. Of course he will. Mom said evenly, your stepfather is just worried about mine. That's all. Besides, that Gabriel won't have to settle for the bean dip. Oh, she added, Gabriel won't have to settle for the bean dip. I'll make him enough 7-layer dip for the whole weekend. Guacamole, sour cream, the works. Gabe softened a bit. So this money for a trip, it comes out of your own college budget, right? Yes, honey, my mother said. And you would take my car anywhere but there and back. We'll be very careful. Dad, Gabe scratched his lip. Maybe if you hurry with the same 7-layer dip, and maybe if the kid apologized for interrupting my poker game, maybe I kick you in the soft spot, I thought, and maybe you sing soprano for a week. But my mom warned me to not make him mad. Why did she put up with this guy? I wanted to scream, why does she care what he thought? I'm sorry, I muttered. I'm really sorry I interrupted your incredibly important poker game. Sorry. Please go back to it right now. Gabe's eyes narrowed. His tiny brain was probably trying to detect sarcasm in my voice. Yeah, whatever, he decided. He went back to his game. Thank you, Percy, said Mum. Once we get out to Montauk, we'll talk more about whatever you've forgotten to tell me, okay? From where I thought, I saw anxiety in her eyes. The same fear I'd seen Grover during the bus ride, as if my mom felt an odd chill in the air. But then a smile returned and I focused, it must be a mistake. He kept griping and groaning about losing her cooking and most importantly his 78 Camaro for the whole weekend. Not a scratch on this car, brain boy, he warned me as I loaded the last bag. Not one little scratch, like I'd be the one driving. I was 12 and that didn't matter to Gabe. If a seagull so much poop on his paint job, he'd find a way to blame me. Watching him lumber back to the apartment, but when I got so much I can't explain, escape me story, I made the hand gesture I'd seen Grover make on the bus, a sort of warding off evil gesture, a clawed hand over my heart, and then a shoving movement towards Gabe's. The screen door slammed shut so hard it whacked him in the butt. Send him flying staircase as if he'd been shot by a cannon. Maybe it was just a window or some freak accident with the hinges, but I didn't stay long enough to find it. I got into Camara and told my mom to step on it. Our rental cabin was on the South Shore, way out at the tip of Long Island. It was a little pastel box with faded curtains half sunken into the dunes. There was always sand in the sheets and spiders in the cabinets, and most of the time the sea was too cold to swim in. I loved the place. We'd been going there since I was a baby. My mom had been there even longer. She never exactly said, but I knew the beach was special to her. It was the place that where she'd met my dad. As we got closer to Montauk, she seemed to grow younger, years of worry and work despair from her face. Her eyes turned the color of the sea. We got there at sunset, opened all the cabinet windows, and went through our usual cleaning routine. We walked on the beach, fed blue corn chips to seagulls, and munched on blue jelly beans, blue saltwater taffy, and all the other free samples my mum had brought from work. I guess I shouldn't explain the blue food. See, Gib had once told my mum there was no such thing. They had to fight, which was really small thing at the time. But every month when I went out of her way to eat blue. She baked blue birthday cake, she mixed blueberry smoothie, she bought blue corn tortilla chips and brought home blue candy from the shop. This along with keeping her maiden name, Jackson, rather than calling her Mrs. Ugliana, were proof that she wasn't totally suckered by Gabe. She did have a rebellious streak like me. When it got dark, we made a fire. We roasted hot dogs and marshmallows. My mom told me stories when she was a kid, back when her parents died in a plane crash. She told me about the book she wanted to write someday and said enough money to quit the candy shop. Eventually, I got up to the door asking what was always on my mom's mind whenever we came to Montauk. My father. Once I went all missing, I figured she would tell me the same thing she always did. I never got tired of hearing it. He was a kind person, she said. Tall, handsome, and powerful, but gentle too. You have the black hair, you know, and his green eyes. Mom fished the blue jelly bean out of a candy bag. I wish he could see Percy. He'd be so proud. What's so great about me? A dyslexic, hypertensive with D-plus report card. Out of school for the sixth time in 6 years. How old was I? I asked him when he left. He watched the flames. He was only with me for one summer, Percy. Right on here at the beach. This time, But he knew me as a baby, no honey, he did. I was expecting the baby, but he never saw you. He had to leave before you were born. I tried to scare that with the fact I seem to remember something about my father, a warm glow, a smile. I always assumed he knew me as a baby. Mom had never said it outright, but still, it felt much better to be true. Now to be told that he never seen me. I felt angry at my father. Maybe it was stupid, but I resented him for going on the ocean voyage, for not having the guts to marry my mom. He left us, and now we were stuck with smelly Gabe. Are you going to send me away again? I asked her to another boarding school. She pulled a mouth right from the fire. I don't know, honey. Her voice was heavy. I think we'll have to do something. Because you don't want me around, I regretted the words as soon as they were out. My mom's eyes welled with tears. She took my hand and squeezed tight. Oh, Percy, no. I have to, honey, for your own good. I have to send you away. Her voice reminded me of what Mr. Bruner said. That it's the best for me to leave Yancy because I'm not normal, I said. You say that if it's a bad thing, Percy, but I don't realize how important you are. I thought Yancy would be far enough away. I thought you'd finally be safe. Safe from what? She met my eyes, and a flood of memories came back to me. All the weird, scary things that had ever happened to me, some of which I'd tried to forget. During third grade, a man in black trench coat had stalked me on the playground when the teachers threatened to call the police. He went away growling. But no one believed that under his broad-brimmed hat, the man was only had one eye, right in the middle of his head. Before that was a really early memory. I was in preschool and a teacher accidentally put me down for a nap in the cot, and then a snake had slithered into. My mom screamed when she came to pick me up and found me playing with a limp, scaly rope. Some thing had strangled to death with my meaty toddler hands. In every single school, something creepy had happened, something unsafe, and I was forced to move. I knew I should tell Mom about the old lady at the fruit stand and Mrs. Dodds at the art museum about my weird hallucination that I had sliced my math teacher into dust with a sword. I couldn't make myself tell her. I had a strange feeling the news would end our trip to Montauk. I didn't want that. I've tried to keep you as close to me as I could, my mom said. She told me that my mistake, but there's only one other option, Percy. The place your father wanted to send, where to send you. And I just can't stand to do it. My father wanted me to go to a special school, not school, a summer camp. My head was spinning. Why would my dad, who hadn't even stayed around long enough to see me born, talk about my mom about summer camp? If there's so important, why hadn't he ever mentioned it before? I'm sorry, Percy, she said, seeing her look in my eyes. I can't talk about it. I couldn't send you there, but I can't talk about it. Couldn't send it there. Place. It could be we say goodbye before you to go for good. For good? It's only some kind. She turned towards the fire and I knew her expression that if more friends, she would start to cry. The night I had a vivid dream. It was a storming on the beach and two beautiful animals, a white horse and a golden eagle, was trying to kill each other at the other end of the surf. The eagle swooped down and slashed the horse's mother with his teeth and the horse reared and kicked back at the eagle's wing. At the fourth, the ground rumbled and a monstrous voice chuckled somewhere beneath the earth, groaning, goading the animals to fight hard. I ran towards them, knowing I had to stop them from killing each other. I was running in slow motion. I knew I would be too late. I saw the eagle slice down its beak, aimed at the horse's wide eyes. I screamed, no, I would quit the start. Outside, it was really stormy, the kind of storm that cracks trees and blows down houses. There was no horse or eagle on the beach, just lightning making false daylight and 5 meter high waves pounding the dunes like artillery. With the next thunderclap, my mom woke. She sat up, eyes wide, and said, hurricane. I knew that was crazy. Don't lie, I never saw hurricanes this early in the summer, but the ocean seemed to have forgotten over the roar of them when I heard a distant bellow and angry tortured sound that made my hair stand on the end. Then a much closer noise, like mouths on the sand, a desperate voice. Someone yelling, pounding at his cabin door. My mom sprang out of the bed and nightgown that threw her open the lock. Grover stand framed in the window, back up pulling my butt. He wasn't actually Grover searching all night, he gasped. What were you thinking? My mother looked at him, not scared of Grover, but why'd he come? Grover said, trying to be heard of. What happened at school? What didn't you tell me? I was frozen, looking at Grover. I couldn't understand what I was seeing. Oh, Zikayuka Tiao, he yelled. It's right behind me. Didn't you tell her? I was too shocked to register that he just cursed an aging brick and understood it perfectly. It was shocked to wonder how Grover had got here by himself in the middle of the night. Grover didn't have his trousers on, but there was legs where his legs should be. My mom looked at me sternly and talked in a tone she'd never used before. Percy, tell me now! I stammered something about the old lady at the fruit stand, Mrs. Dodds. My mom stared at me, her face deathly pale. In the flash of lightning, she grabbed her purse, tossed me in a rain jacket, and said, go to the car, both of you, go! Grover ran for the Camaro, but he wasn't running excited. He was trotting, shaking his shaggy hindquarters, and suddenly his story about a muscular disorder in his legs made sense to me. I understood how he could run so fast because still limp. When he walked, because those feet where his feet should be, there was no feet. There was cloven hooves. Chapter 4. My mother teaches me bullfighting. We tore that through the night along dark country roads. Wind slammed against the Camaro. Rain lashed the windshield. I didn't know how my mum could How my mom could see anything, but she kept her foot on the gas. Every time there was a flash of lightning, I looked at Grover sitting next to me in the back seat, and I wondered if I'd gone insane, or if he was wearing some kind of shag carpet trousers. But no, the smell was one I remember from kindergarten field trips to the petting zoo. Lanolin, like from wool. The smell of wet barnyard animal. All I could think to say was, "So you and my mum know each other?" Grover's eyes flitted to the rear mirror, though there were no cars behind us. "Not exactly," he said. "I mean, we've never met in person, but she knew I was watching you." Sorry. "Watching me? Keeping tabs on you, making sure you were okay." Sorry again. "Wasn't faking being your friend," he added hastily. "I am your friend. What are you exactly?" "That doesn't matter right now. It doesn't matter. From my waist down, my friend is a donkey." Grover let out a sharp, throaty blah. I'd heard him make that sound before, but I always assumed it was a nervous laugh. Now I realized it was more of an irritated bleat. "Goat," he cried. "What? I'm a goat from the waist down." You said it didn't matter. Blah! There are sadists who would trample you under a hoop for such an insult. Who, wait, sadists you mean like Mr. Brunner's myth? Were the old ladies at the fruit stand a myth? Percy, who Mrs. Dodds a myth? So you admit there was Mrs. Dodds? Of course. Then why? The less you know, the fewer monsters you would attract, Grover said, like this should be perfectly obvious. We put mist over the human eyes. We hoped you'd think the kindly one was a hallucination, but it was no good. You started to realize who you are. Who I? Wait a minute, what do you mean? The weird bellowing noise rose up again somewhere behind us, closer than before. Whatever was chasing us was still on our trail. "Percy," my mum said, "there's too much time to explain, and not enough time. We have to get you to safety." "Safe from what? Who's after me?" "Oh, nobody much," Grover said, obviously still miffed about the donkey comment. "Just the Lord of the Dead and a few of his bloodthirstiest minions." "Grover!" "Sorry, Mrs. Jackson, could you drive faster, please?" I tried to wrap around my mind about what was happening, but I couldn't do it. I knew this wasn't a dream. I know imagination. I could never dream up something this weird. My mom made a hard left. We swerved onto a narrower road, racing past darkened farmhouses and wooden hills, and pick your own strawberry signs on white picket fences. "Where are we going?" I said. "The summer camp I told you about." My mother's voice was tight. She was trying for my sake not to be scared. "The place your father wanted to send you." "The place you didn't want me to go?" "Please, dear," my mother begged. "This is hard enough to try to understand. You're in danger because some old ladies cut yarn." "Those weren't old ladies," girl said. "Those were the fates. Do you know what it means? The fact they appeared in front of you. They only do that when you're about to... when someone's about to die." "Whoa," you said, "you." "No, I didn't. I said someone." "You mean you, as in me. I mean you like someone, not you. She pulled the... my boys," my mom said. She pulled the wheel hard to the right. I got a glimpse of a figure she swore to avoid. A dark, fluttering shape now lost behind us in the storm. "What was that?" I asked. "We're almost there," my mother said, ignoring my question. "Another mile, please, please, please." I didn't know where there was, but I found myself leaning forward in the car, anticipating waiting for us to arrive. Outside, nothing but rain and darkness. The kind of empty countryside you get away out on the tip of the Long Island. I thought about Mrs. Dodds and the moment when she changed to the thing with pointed teeth and leathery wings. My limbs went numb from delayed shock. She really hadn't been human. She meant to kill me. Then I thought about Mr. Bruner and the sword he had thrown me. Before I could ask Grover about that, the hair rose on the back of my neck. There was a blinding flash and a jar rattling boom, and a car exploded. I remember feeling weightless, like I was being crushed, fried, and hosed down all at the same time. I peeled my forehead off the back of the driver's seat and said, "Ow!" "Percy," my mom shouted. "I'm okay." I tried to shake off the daze. I wasn't dead. The car hadn't really exploded. We just swerved into a ditch. Our driver's side door was wedged in mud. The roof had been cracked open like an eggshell and rain was pouring in. Lightning. The only explanation, we'd been blasted right off the road. Next to me, the backseat was a big motionless lump. Grover! He was slumped over, blood trickling from the side of his mouth. I shook his furry hip, thinking, "No, even if you are a half-blinded animal, you're my best friend, and I don't want you to die." He groaned, "Food." And I knew there was hope. "Percy," my mom said, "we have to." Her voice faltered. I looked back, and a fall of lightning through the mud splattered rear windshield. I saw a figure lumbering towards us on the shoulder of the road. The sight of it made my skin crawl. It was a dark silhouette of a huge guy, like a football player. He seemed to be holding a blanket over his head. His top half was bulky and fuzzy. Sorry. He upraised his hand and made it look like he had horns. I saw, "Who is Percy?" My mom said deadly serious, "Get out of the car." My mom threw herself against the driver's seat door. It was jammed shut in the mud. I tried mine, stuck too. I looked up desperately at the hole in the roof. It might be an exit, but the edges were sizzling and smoking. "Climb out the passenger seat," my mom told me. "Percy, you have to run. Do you see that big tree?" "What?" Another flash of lightning through the smoke in the roof. I saw the tree she meant, a huge White House Christmas tree pine at the crest of the nearest hill. "That's the property line. Get over the hill and you'll see a big farmhouse down in the valley. Run and don't look back. Yell for help. Don't stop until you reach the door." "Mom, you're coming too." Her face was pale, her eyes as sad as when she looked at the ocean. "No," I shouted, "you are coming with me. Help me carry Grover." "Food," Grover moaned a little louder. The man with the blanket on his head kept coming towards us, making a grunting, snorting noise as he got closer. I realized he couldn't be holding a blanket over his head because his hands, huge meaty hands, were swinging at his sides. There was no blanket, meaning the bulk, fuzzy mass that was too big to be his head was his head. And the points that looked like horns, "He doesn't want us," my mother told. "He wants you. Besides, I can't cross the property line." "But we don't have time, Percy. Go, please." I got mad, then mad at my mother, at Grover, the goat, at the thing with horns that was lumbering towards us slowly and deliberately, like a bull. I climbed across Grover and pushed the door open into the rain. "We're going together. Come on, Mom." "I told you. Mom, I'm not leaving you. Help me with Grover." I didn't wait for her answer. I scrambled outside, dragging Grover from the car. He was surprisingly light, but I could have carried him very far if my mom hadn't come to my aid. Together, we draped Grover's arm over our shoulder and started stumbling uphill through the wet, waist-high grass. Glancing back, I got my first clear look at the monster. He was 7 feet tall, easy. His arms and legs looked like something from the cover of Muscle Man magazine. Bulging biceps and triceps, and a bunch of other seps, all stuffed like basketball under vein web skin. He wore no clothes except underwear. I mean bright white, fruit of the looms, which would have been funny for the top half of the body. Coarse brown hair started at about his belly button and got thicker as it reached his shoulders. His neck was a mass of muscle and fur leading up to an enormous head, which has a snout as large as my arm, snotty nostrils, with with a gleaming brass ring, cruel black eyes and horns, enormous black and white horns with points you just couldn't get from an electric sharpener. I realized the monster, all right, he'd been one of the first, or Mr. Bruno told us, but he couldn't be real. I blinked the ray out of my mind. That's Pacific Sun, my mother said. I knew that badly, that they want to kill you. But he's a man. Don't say his name, she warned. Names of power. The pine tree was still way too far. 100 meters uphill at least. I glanced behind me. The bullhound hunched over our car, looking in the window, or not looking exactly. More like snuffling and nuzzling. I wasn't sure why he bothered, since we were only about 15 meters away. Food, Grover moaned. Shh, I told him. Mom, what's he doing? Doesn't he see us? His sight and hearing are terrible, she said. He goes by smell, but he'll figure out where we are soon enough. As if on cue, the bullman bellowed and raged. He picked up Gage's Camaro by the torn roof and the chassis creaking and groaning. He raised the car over his head and threw it down the road. It slammed into a wet asphalt and skidded it down the road. It slammed into the wet asphalt and skidded in the shower sparks for about half a mile before coming to a stop. The gas tank exploded. Not a crack, scratch, scratch, or crack, I remember Gabe saying. Oops. Percy, my mum said, when he sees us, he'll charge. Wait until the last thing, then jump out of the way. Directly sideways. He can't change direction very well once he's charging. Do you understand? How do you know all this? I've been worried about an attack for a long time. I should have expected this. I was selfish keeping me near you, but another billow of rage, and the bullman started tromping uphill. He'd smell us. The pine tree was only a few more meters away, but the hill was getting steeper and slicker, and Grover wasn't getting any lighter. The bullman closed in. Another few seconds, and he'd be on top of us. My mother must have been exhausted, but she shouldered Grover. Go, Percy, separate. Remember what I said. I didn't want to split up, but I had a feeling she was right. It was our only chance. I sprinted to the left, turned, and saw the creature bearing down on me. His black eyes glowed with hate. He reeked like rotten meat. He lowered his head and charged. Those razor-sharp horns aimed straight at my chest. The fear in my stomach made me want to bolt, but that wouldn't work. I could never outrun this thing, so I held my ground, and at least at the last moment, I jumped to the side. The bullman stormed past us like a freight train. Then he bellowed with frustration and turned. But not towards me, this time towards my mother, who was sitting over down in the grass. We reached the crest of the hill. Down the other side, I could see just a sea of valley, just as my mom had said, and the lights of a farmhouse glowing yellow through the rain. But there was a half a mile away. We'd never make it. The bullman grunted, pouring down. He kept eyeing my mother, who was now retreating slowly downhill, back towards the road, trying to lead the monster away from Grover. Run, Percy, she told me. I can't go any further. Run! But I just stood there, frozen in fear, as the monster charged her. She tried to sidestep, as she told me to, but the monster had learned his lesson. His hand shot out and grabbed her by the neck. As she turned away, he lifted her and she struggled, kicking, pummeling the air. Mom! She caught my eyes, managed to choke out one last word. Go! Then with an angry roar, the monster closed his finger around my mother's neck and she dissolved before my eyes, melting into light, a shimmery golden form as if she was a holographic projection. A blinding flash and she was simply gone. No! Anger replaced my fear. Newfound strength burned into my limbs. The same rush of energy I got when Mrs. Dodge grew talons. Sorry. The bullman bore down on Grover, who lay helpless in the grass. The monster hunched over, snuffling my best friend, as he was about to lift Grover up and make him dissolve too. I couldn't light up. I stripped off my red rain jacket. Hey! I screamed, waving the jacket Run to one side of the monster. Hey, stupid ground beef. Rawr! The monster turned towards me, shaking his meaty fist. I had an idea, a stupid idea. But better than no idea at all. I put my back to the big pine tree and waved my red jacket in front of the bull man, thinking I'd jump out of the way at the last moment. But it didn't happen like that. The bull man charged too fast, his arms out to grab me. Whichever way I tried to dodge, time slowed down, my legs tensed. I couldn't jump sideways, so I leaped straight up, kicking off from the creature's head, using it as a springboard, turning into midair and landing on its neck. How did I do that? I didn't have time to figure out. A millisecond later, the monster head slammed into the tree, and the impact nearly knocked my teeth out. The bull man staggered around trying to shake me. I locked my arms around his horn to keep from being thrown. Thunder and lightning were still going strong. The rain was in my eyes. The smell of rotten meat burned my nostrils. The monster shook himself around and bucked like a rodeo bull. He should have just backed up into the tree and smashed me flat. But I was starting to realize that this thing had only one gear, forward. Meanwhile, Grover started groaning in the grass. I wanted to yell at him to shut up, but the way I was getting tossed around, if I opened my mouth, I'd bite my own tongue off. Food, Grover moaned. The bull man wheeled towards him, pawed the ground again, and got ready to charge. I thought about how he had squeezed the life out of my mother, made her disappear in a flash of light, and rage filled me like a high-octane fuel. I got both hands around one horn and pulled back with all my might. The monster tail gave a surprised grunt and then snap! The woman screamed and flung me through the air. I landed flat on my back. My head smacked against a rock. When I sat up, my vision was blurred, but I had a horn in my hand. A ragged bone weapon the size of a knife. The monster charged. Without thinking, I rolled to one side and came up, kneeling as the monster's barreled past. I drew the broken horn through into his side, right up and under his furry rib cage. The bull man roared in agony. He flailed, clawing at his chest, then began to disintegrate. Not like my mother in a flash of golden light, but like crumbling sand blown away in chunks by the wind. The same way Mrs. Dodd had burst apart. The monster was gone. The rain had stopped. The storm still rumbled, but only in the distance. I smelled like livestock, and my knees were shaking. My head felt like it was splitting open. I was weak and scared and trembling with grief. I just seen my mother vanish. I wanted to lie down and cry, but there was Grover needing my help, so I managed to haul him up and stagger down into the valley towards the lights of the farmhouse. I was crying, calling for my mother, but I held on to Grover. I wasn't going to let him go, too. The last thing I remember is collapsing on a wooden porch, looking up at the ceiling fan circling above me. Moths flying around a yellow light and the stern face of a familiar-looking bearded man and a pretty girl. Her blonde hair curled like Cinderella's. They both looked down at me, and the girl said, "He's the one. He must be." "Silence, Annabeth," the man said. "He's still conscious. Bring him inside."
Chapter 5. I play Pinocchio with a horse. I have weird dreams full of barnyard animals. Most of them want to kill me. The rest wanted food. I must have woke up several times, but what I heard and saw made no sense. So I just passed out again. I remember lying in a soft bed, being spoon-fed something that tasted like a buttered popcorn, only it was pudding. The girl with curly blonde hair hovered over me, smirking as she scraped drips off my chin with the spoon. When she saw me, my eyes open, she asked what will happen at the summer solstice. I managed to croak, "What?" She looked around as if someone would overhear. "What's going on? What was stolen? We've only got a few weeks." "I'm sorry," I mumbled. Somebody knocked in the door and the girl quickly filled my mouth with pudding. The next time I woke up, the girl was gone. A husky blonde dude like a surfer stood in the corner of the bedroom keeping watch over me. He had blue eyes, at least a dozen of them, on his cheeks, his forehead, and the back of his hands. When I finally came around for good, there was nothing weird about my surroundings, except they were nicer than I was used to. I was sitting in a deck chair on a huge porch, gazing across a meadow at green hills in the distance. The breeze smelled like strawberries. There was a blanket over my legs, a pillow behind my neck. All that was great, but my mouth felt like a scorpion had been using it for a nest. My tongue was dry and nasty, and every one of my teeth hurt. On the table next to me was a tall drink. It looked like iced apple juice with a green straw and a paper parasol sucked through a maraschino cherry. My hands were so weak I almost dropped the glass once I got my fingers all around it. "Careful," a feminine voice said. Grover was leaning against the porch railing, looking like he didn't sleep in a week. Under one arm, he cradled a shoebox. Sorry. Converse high tops and a bright orange t-shirt that said Camp Half-Blood. Just plain old Grover, not the goat boy. So maybe I'd have a nightmare. Maybe my mom was okay. Sorry, again. And we stopped here at the Big Up for some reason and... "You saved my life," Grover said. "Well, the least I could do." I went back to the hill. "I thought you might want this." Reverently, he placed a shoebox in my lap. Inside was a black and white bull's horn, the base jagged from being broken off. The tip splattered with dry blood. "It hadn't been a nightmare," the mentor, I said. "It isn't a good idea. That's what they call it in Greece, myths, isn't it?" I demanded. The mentor, half man, half bull. Grover shifted uncomfortably. "You've been out for 2 days. How much do you remember?" "My mom. Is she really?" He looked down. I stared across the meadows. There were groves of trees, a winding stream, acres of strawberries spread out under the blue sky. The valley was surrounded by rolling hills, and the tallest one, directly in front of us, was the one with the huge pine tree on top. Even that looked beautiful in the sunlight. My mother was gone. The whole world should be black and cold. Nothing should look beautiful. "I'm sorry, Grover," sniffled. "I'm a failure. I'm the worst sailor in the world." He moaned, stomping his foot so hard it came off. The Converse high top came off. The inside was filled with styrofoam except for a huge shaped hole. "Oh, sticks," he mumbled. Thunder rolled across the clear sky. As he tried to get his hoof back on in the fake foot, I thought, well, that settles it. Grover was a sailor. I was ready to bet that if I had shaved his curly brown hair, I'd find tiny horns on his head. But I was too miserable to care that stages exist, or even minotaurs. Sorry, Dan. All that meant was my mum really had been squeezed into nothingness, dissolved into yellow light. I was alone, an orphan. I would have to live with Smelly Gabe. No, that would never happen. I would live on the streets first. I would pretend I was 17 and join the army. I'd do something. Grover was still sniffling. The poor kid, the poor goat, Seda or whatever, looked as if he expected to be hit. I said, "It wasn't your fault." "Yes, it was. I was supposed to protect you." "Can my mother ask you to protect me?" "No, but that's my job. I'm a keeper. At least I was." "But why?" I suddenly felt dizzy. My vision started swimming. "Don't strain yourself," Grover said. "Here." He helped me hold the glass and put the straw to my lips. I recoiled at the taste before I was expecting apple juice. It wasn't that at all. It was chocolate chip cookies, liquid cookies. And not just any cookies, my mum's homemade blue chocolate chip cookies. Buttery and hot, with the chip still melting. Drinking it, my body felt warm and good, full of energy. My grief didn't go away, but I felt that my mum had just brushed my hair against my cheek. gave me a cookie the way she used to be when I was small and told me everything was going to be okay. Before I knew it, I drained the glass and stared into it. I just had a warm drink, but the ice cubes hadn't even melted. Was it good? Grandpa asked. I nodded. What does it taste like? He said to a whisper. I felt guilty. Sorry, I shouldn't let you taste it. His eyes got wide. No, that's not what I meant. I just wondered. Chocolate chip cookies, I said. My mom's homemade. He sighed. And how do you feel? Like a throw Nancy Boba Fett 100 meters. That's good, he said. That's good. I don't think you should risk drinking any more of that stuff. What do you mean? He took the empty glass from me gingerly as if it was dynamite and set it back on the table. Come on, Chiron and Mr. D are waiting. The porch wrapped all the way around the farmhouse. My legs felt wobbly trying to walk that far. Grover offered to carry the mental horn, but I held on to it. I paid for that souvenir the hard way. I wasn't going to let it go. As he came around the opposite end of the house, I caught my breath. As we came across the opposite end of the house, I caught my breath. We must have been on the north shore of Long Island, because on this side of the house, the valley marched all the way to Long Island Sound, which glittered about a mile in the distance. Between here and there, I simply couldn't process everything I was seeing. The landscape was dotted with buildings that looked like ancient Greek architecture, an open-air pavilion, an amphitheater, a circular arena, except that they all looked brand new, their white marble columns sparkling in the sun. In a nearby sand pit, a dozen high school-aged kids and sailors played volleyball. Canoes glided across a small lake. Kids in bright orange t-shirts like Rose's were chasing each other around a cluster of cabins nestled in the woods. Some shot targets at an archery range. Others rode horses down a wooden trail, and unless I was hallucinating, some of the horses had wings. Down at the end of the porch, two men sat across from each other at a card table. The blonde-haired girl who spoon-fed me popcorn-flavored pudding was leaning on the porch next to them. The man facing me was small, but porky. He had red nose, big watery eyes, and curly hair, so black it was almost purple. He looked like those painted of baby angels. What do you call them? Hubbubs? No, cherub. Cherub. That's it. He looked like a cherub who turned middle-aged in a trailer park. He wore a tiger pattern Hawaiian shirt, and he would have fitted right in one of Gabe's poker parties. Except, I got a feeling this guy could have even outgambled even my stepfather. That's Mr. D, Grover murmured to me. He's the camp director. Be polite. The girl that Annabeth chased, she's just a camper, but she's been here longer than just about anybody. And you already know Chiron. He pointed the guy whose back was to me. First, I realized he was sitting in a wheelchair. Then I recognized the tweed jacket, the thinning brown hair, the scraggly beard. Mr. Bruno, I cried. The Latin teacher turned a smile at me. His eyes had that mischievous glint that they sometimes got in class when he pulled a pop quiz and made all the multiple choice answers B. Ah, good, Percy, he said. Now we have four for Pinocchio. He offered me a chair right to the right of Mr. D. He looked at me with bloodshot eyes and heaved a great sigh. Oh, I'm supposed to must say welcome to Camp Half-Blood. But now don't expect me to be glad to see you. Thanks. I scooted a little further away from him. Because if there's one thing I had learned from living with Gabe, it's that how when a dog had been hitting apple juice. If Mr. D was a stranger to alcohol, I was a stater. Annabeth, Mr. Bruno called to a blonde girl. She came forward and Mr. Bruce introduced her. This young lady nursed you back to health. Percy, Annabeth, my dear, why don't you check on Percy's bunk? We'll be putting him in a cabin 11 for now. Annabeth said, sure, Caron. She was probably my age, but maybe a couple of centimeters taller and a whole lot more athletic looking, with a deep tan and a curly brown hair. She was always exactly what I thought. A stereotypical California girl would look like, except her eyes ruined the image. They were startling gray, like storm clouds, pretty but intimidating too, as if she was analyzing the best way to take me down in a fight. She glanced at the mentor hold in my hands, then back at me. You killed a mentor. I imagined she was going to say, you killed a mentor. Oh, wow, yeah, you're so amazing, or something like that. Instead, she said, you drool when you sleep. Then she sprinted off down the lawn, her blonde hair flying behind her. So I said, anxious to change the subject, you work here, Mr. Bruner? Not Mr. Bruner's, the ex-Mr. Bruner, I'm afraid. I'm afraid that was Sidonym. You may call me Kiran. Okay, totally confused. I looked at the director and Mr. D. Does that stand for something? Mr. D, he stopped shuffling the cards. He looked like me as I belched loudly. Young man, names are powerful things. You don't go around in them for no reason. Alright, sorry, I must say, Percy, Caron Bruner broke in. I'm glad to see you alive. It's been a long time since I made a horse call to a potential camper. I'd hate to think I've wasted my time. House call? My yet, Nancy Academy to instruct you. We have stayed at more schools, of course, keeping a lookout. But Grover alerted me as soon as he met you. He sensed you were something special, so I decided to come upstate, convinced the other Latin teachers to take a leave of absence. I tried to remember the beginning of the school year. It seemed like so long ago, but I had a fuzzy memory of there being another Latin teacher in my first week of Yancey. Then, without explanation, he disappeared and Mr. Bruner had taken the class. You came to Yancey to teach me? I asked. Caron nodded. Honestly, I wasn't sure about you at first. We contacted your mother to let her know we were keeping an eye on you, in case you were ready for Camp Half-Blood. But you still had so much to learn. Nevertheless, you made it here alive, and that's always the first test. Grover, Mr. D said impatiently, are you playing or not? Yes, sir, Grover trembled as he took the fourth chair. Though I didn't know why he should be so afraid of a pudgy little man in a tiger print Hawaiian shirt. You do know how to play Pinocchio, Mr. D eyed me suspiciously. I'm afraid not. I said, I'm afraid not, sir, he said. Sir, I repeated, I was liking the camp director less and less. Well, he told me, it is along with the gladiator fighting and Pac-Man, one of the most greatest games ever invented by humans. I would expect all civilized young men to know how to play, know the rules. I'm sure the boy can learn, Caron said. Please, Isaiah, what is this place? What am I doing here? Caron, why would you go to Nancy just to teach me? Mr. D snorted. I asked the same question. The camp director dealt the cards. Grover flinched every time one landed in his pile. Caron smiled at me sympathetically, the way he used to do in Latin class, as if to let me know that no matter what my average was, I was still his star student. He expected me to know the right answer. Percy, he said, did your mother tell you nothing? She said, I remember the sad eyes looking out at the sea. She told me she was afraid to send me there, even though my father had wanted her to. She said once I was there, I probably couldn't leave. She wanted to keep me close to her. Typical, Mr. D said. That's how they usually get killed, young man. Are you bidding or not? What? I exclaimed impatiently. How to bid in Pinocchio? So I did. I'm afraid it's too much to tell, Carl said. Afraid our usual orientation film won't be sufficient. Orientation film? I asked. No, Chiron. Well, Percy, you know, a friend Grover said, and he pointed to the horn and Shuba, that the Kilimator no small threat either. That. What you may not know is that great powers are at work. Gods, the forces you call the Greek gods, are very much alive. I stared at the others around the table. I waited for someone to yell, "Not!" But all I got was Mr. D yelling, "Oh, a royal marriage. Trick, trick." He cuckled as he tallied up his points. "Mr. D," Grover asked timidly, "if we're not going to eat it, can I have your Diet Coke can?" All right. Grover bit a huge shard of the empty aluminum can and chewed it mournfully. "Wait," I told him on. "You told me there's such thing as a god." "Well, now," said God, capital G, God. "That's a different matter altogether. We shan't deal with the metaphysical." "Metaphysical? But you were talking about gods, plural, are in great beings that control the forces of nature and human and devours. The immortal gods of Olympus, that's a smaller matter." "Smaller?" "Yes, quite. The gods we discovered in Latin class. Zeus, Saturn, Hera, Apollo, you mean them?" And there it was again, a distant thunder on a cloudless day. "Young man," said Mr. D, "I would rather be less casual about throwing those names around if I were you. But the stories, they're myths to explain lightning and seasons and stuff. That's what the people believed before there was science." "Science," Mr. D scoffed. "And tell me, Percy Jackson." I flinched when he said my real name, which I never told anybody. "What will people think of your science 2,000 years from now?" Mr. D continued. "We'll call it a primitive mumbo jumbo. That's what. I love mortals. They have absolutely no sense of perspective. They think they've come so far, and have they, Chiron? Look at the boy. Look at this boy and tell me." I wasn't liking Mr. D much, but there was something about the way he called me mortal as if he wasn't. It was enough to put a lump in my throat to suggest why Grover was dutifully minding his cards, chewing his soda can, and keeping his mouth shut. "Percy," Chiron said, "you may choose to believe or not, but the fact is, immortals meet immortals. Can you imagine for a moment never dying, never fading? Existing just as you are for all time?" I was about to answer off the top of my head that it sounded a pretty good deal, but the tone of Chiron's made me hesitate. "You mean whether people believe or not?" I said. "Exactly," Chiron said. "If you were a god, how would you like to be called a myth? An old story to explain lightning. What if I told you, Percy Jackson, that people will call you a myth? Just created to explain how little boys just got losing their mothers." My heart pounded. He was trying to make me angry for some reason, but I was going to let him. "I wouldn't like it, but I don't believe in gods." "Oh, you'd better," Mr. D murmured, before one of them incinerates you. Grover said, "Please, sir, he's just lost his mother. He's in shock." "A lucky thing, too," Mr. D grumbled, playing a card. "Bad enough, I'm confined to this miserable job, working with boys who don't even believe." He waved his hand and a goblet appeared on the table, as if the sunlight had bent itself momentarily and woven the air into glass. The goblet filled itself with red wine. My jaw dropped, but Chiron hardly looked up. "Mr. D," he warned, "your restrictions." Mr. D looked in the wine and fine surprise. "Dear me," he looked at the sky and yelled, "old habit, sorry." More thunder. Mr. D waved his hand again. The wine glass changed into a fresh can of Diet Coke. He sighed unhappily and popped open the top of the soda and went back to his game. Chiron winked at me. Mr. D offended his father a while back, took a fancy to a wood nymph who'd been declared off limits. A wood nymph unpreted still staying and took Diet Coke like it was from outer space. Wait, another century he was allowed to go back to Olympus. "Man, Olympus," I said, "you're telling me there's a place like that?" the conference point of their palace, which did indeed used to be on Mount Olympus. It's called Mount Olympus out of respect to the old ways, but the palace never moved, Percy, just as the gods do. You mean the Greek gods, or are like in America? Well, suddenly the gods move with the heart of the West. The what? Come on, Percy, what do you call Western civilization? Do you think it's just an abstract concept, no, it's living force? A collective consciousness had been burned for brighter for 1,000 years. The gods are part of it. You might even say they are the source of it, or at least they are tied tightly to it. So they possibly could never fade. Not unless a Western civilization were obliterated. The fire started in Greece. Then, as you well know, or as I hope you know, since you passed my course, the heart of the flame moved to Rome, and so did the gods. Or different names, perhaps Jupiter for Zeus, Venus for Aphrodite, and so on. But the same forces, the same gods. And then they died. No, did the West die? The gods suddenly moved to Germany, to France, to Spain for a while, wherever the flame was brightest. The gods were there. They spent several centuries in England. All you need to do is look at the architecture. People do not forget the gods. Every place they ruled for the last 3,000 years, and you can see them in paintings, in statues, and the most important buildings. And yes, Percy, of course, they are now in the United States. Look at the symbol, the eagle of Zeus. Look at the statue of Prometheus in Rockefeller Center. The Greek facades of your government building in Washington. I invite you to find any American city where the Olympics are not prominently displayed in multiple places. Like it or not, and believe me, plenty of people weren't very fond of Rome either. America is now the heart of the flame. It's the great power of the West, and so the Olympus is there, and we are here. It was all too much, especially the fact I seem to be included in Chiron's we, as if I was part of some club. Who are you, Chiron? Who am I? Chiron smiled. He shifted his weight as if he was going to get up off his wheelchair, but I knew that was impossible. He was paralyzed from the waist down. Who are you, he mused. Well, that's the question all want answered, isn't it? But for now, we should get you to Bunk 11. There you'll meet some new friends and plenty of time for lessons tomorrow. Besides, there will be toast and marshmallows at the campfire tonight, and I simply adore them. And then he did ride from the wheelchair, but there was something odd about the way he did. His blankets fell away from his legs, but the legs didn't move. His waist kept getting longer, rising above his belt. At first, I thought he was wearing a very long white velvet underwear, but as he kept rising out of the chair, taller than any man, I found that the velvet underwear wasn't underwear. It was the front of an animal, muscles and sinew under a coarse white fur, and the wheelchair wasn't a chair. It was some kind of container, an enormous box of wheels. It must have been magic, because there's no way it could have held all of him. A leg came out, long and knobbly knee, with a huge polished hoof. Then another front leg, then hindquarters, and then the box was empty. Nothing but a small metal shell with a couple of fake human legs attached. I stared at the horse who had just sprung from the wheelchair. A huge white stallion. But where its neck should have been, but was my upper body of my lesson teacher, smoothly grafted to his horse trunk. What a relief, the centaur said. I've been cooped up in there so long. My fetlocks have fallen asleep. Now come on, Percy Jackson. Let's meet the campers.